listener, and welcome to another podcast episode of 10 Laws with East Forest. This is a podcast where we explore through conversation, talk to people, and talk about things like spirituality, consciousness, music, technology, dogs, ecology, you know, all those things mashed up together, a dog ecology, music, technology monster. Just whatever we want to, whatever comes up along the way. This is really about creating new stories and offering a chance for all of us to be inspired about how to live wisely and well. If you do enjoy this podcast, please take a moment and give it a review over at iTunes. 5 stars goes a long way. You know, if you just take 1 minute, it makes a big difference in the sustainability of this work. You can also, of course, listen to East Forest on Spotify and buy music and come to live shows and talk about it online. All those things really make a big difference in keeping the sustainability of this ship just moving forward. So I really appreciate it. If you do want to send any money our way to help offset these costs, you can do that with PayPal at info@eastforest.org. That's also how you can send questions and comments that hopefully I will get to and potentially address on this podcast. So my guest for today is Morning Alters, otherwise known as Day Shilkret, and he's someone that I've known for a long time. He also came down to the East Forest Retreat and joined us there, led some workshops, some altar making. And by the way, that's something, we have a few spots left, so you can sign up for that. That's coming up in the fall. Check it out, eastforest.org/retreat. But Day is someone that I've known for a really long time. Actually, we go back probably 10 or 15 years to the New York City days. And we met in pretty different circumstances to how I'm living my life today. And it's something that I'll just go ahead and tell you, but it's not something that I really talk about much because I don't like to. But here it goes. I was an actor. Yes, I feel like I'm in an AA meeting. My name is Trevor, and I was an actor. And in my 20s, that's something that I was pursuing. And I was in New York City, and I was cast in a play that a friend of mine wrote, Anton Dudley. And he wrote this play called Going Home. And in the play, I played a flaming homosexual, like way over the top. And I spoke 100 miles an hour. My name is Tristan, or the character's name is Tristan. And it was a lot of fun. It was very funny. And Day was the director. It was a 15, 20 minute short play that we did at some festival, I think down at MCT downtown. And we had a lot of fun together. And after that, we became friends and we both were evolving on our courses in life spiritually. And he was always someone that was a bit on like the vanguard, a bit in front of me spiritually. And he was always challenging me and asking me to, you know, go a little deeper. And one, like, I remember he was the person who invited me, well, or I should say encouraged me to go to my first ayahuasca ceremony in 2008. And he had gone up and he had a very profound experience, very difficult, but profound. And he immediately asked me, when are you going to go? And I thought, I don't know. I don't have plans to do this. This is not something, I mean, the only thing I'd heard about it at that time, I'd read a Rolling Stone article that featured Daniel Pinchbeck, and he described wearing an eye mask and a diaper and having a bucket. So I was just, this was not a stunning endorsement for the experience, but I was going through a lot of things at that time, and eventually I did muscle up the courage, and I went, and it was good. And it was one of many steps that Day and I sort of did together that led us to continue to be growing as friends and growing as souls. And it's just been a really beautiful, beautiful journey. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. This is Morning Alters. I'm sure we'll have him back. Enjoy. Mr. Day, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So you're known, your work is known as Morning Altars, and you and I have known each other a long time.
It's true. Yeah.
And it's beautiful stuff.
Although a long time is, you know, subjective, right? I mean, we've known each other for 10 years, but
that's a long time.
It's going to be awesome when we're like old men, 70 years old, and we could say we've known each other for, you know, 40.
Yeah, we'll be doing this in like hyperspace and holographic realities of each. This is just an audio podcast. But, you know, I like audio podcasts because I think it harkens back to the radio days, and your imagination really gets to go wild. It's sort of like reading a book. Like you get to imagine the space and the people. It takes away the other senses in a sense.
Yeah, it's old. It's like a long version. It's an old version of storytelling. You know,
yeah.
You're just listening to each other, and you get to imagine kind of like you're not being told the images. You get to imagine it.
Right, right. Well, look, I want to talk about your work, and I want to talk about process. And you've been doing the Morning Altars thing for a few years, and it's expanded and grown into different things. I know you've been working on a book, you've been doing workshops, and even the process itself for what it means for you. But I mean, before we get into that, could you just take me back briefly and like how you even started making earth altars at all? Like how did you walk into a life where this became a life and a business?
Yeah, it's a very odd and compelling story. I mean, I'd say the earliest memory I have of doing this work is when I was 5 years old. I was the kid that would run outside on the driveway and save the worms after a rainstorm.
Where'd you grow up at five?
New York. This was in New York. This is in Dix Hills. And so I would help the little worms onto a leaf, each one of them. I'd poke a little hole in the ground. I'd kind of help these little pathetic creatures get back into the earth. And then I just naturally would decorate each of the holes with bark and berries and sticks and flowers. And there was like this constellation of little worm holy morning altars on my driveway. I mean, on the front lawn. And so that was the first memory I think I had since I was 5 years old. And then, you know, I've always been drawn to earth art, you know, watching Rivers and Tides when I was a kid. Andy Goldsworthy's film.
Yeah. The documentary of his.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, he's got a new film coming out right now, which I'm pretty excited about. Rivers and Tides was pretty monumental for me. It was like watching a meditation of someone kind of experiencing the nexus between art and transience. And it was very impactful. And throughout the course of my life so far, I've always had these like parallel careers that were happening. You know, I was working on Broadway, which is and off Broadway, which is where you and I met in the theater scene in New York. And
which is a story in itself.
It's true. That's true. Yeah, many stories. And I was a professional in the Jewish community, which is a whole other story, a whole other thread of my existence. But kind of running parallel to those stories were this love and calling to be outside and to make beauty with the earth.
Right.
And so, you know, through my 20s, I found myself in different artists in residencies, kind of living. I lived at a retreat center in upstate New York for 2 summers, building art on their forest path, and making like crazy art installations that were like, I had no fucking idea what I was doing. And I was just like sewing leaves together and making like cathedral ceilings out of leaves. And like, I like got like thousands of red feathers and sewed them together and made like covered an entire half a tree with like a red feathered skirt. I mean, I was just playing, you know, but there was something about just being outside, making beauty with the earth, and then like helping people kind of come into a place of wonder and imagination with the landscape. And that was very attractive to me. It felt almost like it felt almost like I was engaging or starting, initiating a ritual at the time. Right. And then most recently, about 5 years ago, I had a, which you remember, I had a pretty unsettling breakup with my previous partner. And this practice of making earth art, which I was actually doing for my birthday every year, I actually employed it to help me with my grief. And so I just would take my dog Rudy and we'd go outside and we would, just take a basket and basically I would take my sorry ass on a walk every day.
Yeah.
And
this is in the East Bay.
Yeah. I'm in Richmond in Wildcat Canyon, which you've been to, and you know how beautiful it is here. And
that's interesting. Like that the genesis was grief.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, none of my practices were really inspiring me at the time. Like yoga was not working. Meditation felt too heavy. Like, but I had this responsibility to take Rudy out on a walk every day.
Yeah. Dogs are very grounding in that sense of getting you outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the city, at least.
You have Kaya. Yeah, exactly. Or even wherever. It's like you have a responsibility to get them outside and therefore to get your ass outside. And so, you know, Rudy basically took me out because I probably would have just stayed in my house and like just been sad all day.
Yeah.
And she got me outside and I just can't help, you know, this one time her and I were walking and we saw these like crop of amber colored mushrooms under this eucalyptus tree up in the hills. I wrote about this in the book actually in the introduction and I was just like so taken with the beauty, man. Like the fog, it was like this perfect moment. The fog was rolling in. It was right after dawn. Mm-hmm. It felt magical. And the mushrooms just looked like they were painted in watercolor. And
do you know what kind of mushrooms they were?
I don't.
Have you seen them since? I mean,
they grow all
a crop.
They grow all around here. And I just like sat my ass down and just started to arrange like eucalyptus bark and buttons and the mushrooms. And 2 hours later, I just emerged from there and I actually felt lighter. Like I actually felt like my grief was moved in a way that nothing else was moving it. And so that was 5 years ago. And I gave myself kind of a little bit of a challenge to see if I could do it for 30 days from that day, just like as a way to process my grief. Yeah. And I haven't stopped. It's been years.
This brings up something really interesting for me personally, because I think a lot about creativity and its role in mental health. And I think that, you know, what makes us unique as humans, one of the things, like humor is one, right? Another is our ability to be creative and create. And it seems to be something about a birthright of ours. And it's probably only in the last, like, maybe 100 years that we started abdicating this process to other people. For instance, we pay other people to sing for us, right? We're like, you're better at that, so I'll pay you and you sing for me, versus before everyone sang. And we all can sing. We have judgment about who's better or not. Right. And it gets to this core of you when you lose your sense of creative process that everyone has. This could be cooking, could be writing. In some ways, it's even just teaching or mothering or anything as a sort of creative act. But I feel like the more you really get into it, it unlocks something very healing and pleasurable. Mm-hmm. I know this is true for myself, you know. Did we talk about, you and I, that book, The War of Art? Did I ever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you showed it to me.
Yeah, and like in a nutshell, it talks about how if you're a writer or an artist, doing that work is important sort of first thing in the day because it's a monkey on your back, right? And if you can kind of just get it done, even if it's 15 minutes, for me it's rehearsing or playing, the day now has meaning. But what I mean by that is that it sort of like lets me off from the hook some way as a person. Like, you know, and like the way you're saying it helped you work through your grief and nothing else was quite working. Mm-hmm. Doing something creative, like, I don't know, I just think that's a really powerful lesson for all, a reminder, you know, and something have to do each day.
I think that I think what you're speaking to is something about finding our way back to our humanity, and which I think is in, it's in, you know, it's a fugitive these days. You know, and I think we, and especially with technology and people working more than ever, I mean, I think that we're losing our humanity. And there's something about creativity that kind of brings us back into our original birthright. And but the thing is that the kind of the examples you gave, I mean, I think that they might be true. Even the book that you mentioned, like, it's very relevant for people that have that calling, like me and you, to, you know, to be creative. But there's a lot of people who don't feel that for whatever reason. You know, like, maybe it's just it hasn't been encouraged in their life.
Or, absolutely.
You know, but the thing is that, especially with my art, and maybe even with yours and your, you know, your concerts and ceremonies, like, my art is, anyone can do it. You know, you don't have to be an artist. And actually, I've challenged so many people who actually use that as an excuse to not try. You know, they're like, well, I'm not creative. And I'm just like, you can't fuck it up.
Right. That phrase right there is the perfect, the key to unlock it. Like, I am not creative. Like,
yeah.
Anyone can make one of your altars. Anyone can free write, you know,
yeah.
Just write on a page. Like, it's a way also of like connecting with your unconscious. It's a way of exercising that unconscious out, and it's a way of connecting with your body and your heart. These like these muscles that you have that you're not using.
Yeah.
You know, right? They get atrophied, and it's part of your humanness isn't being activated. It's really important.
And also, it's a connector. It's literally a connector to, it could be connected to the land. It could be connected to your ancestry. It could be connected to your family. It could be connected to people that, strangers that you don't know. It could be connected to your spirit. I mean, but the thing is that, I mean, that's the etymology of the word art, which means it's a something that connects or a bridge. And, you know, I think we have, look, in the culture we live in, which is really a culture of commodity, we've basically taken art and we've made it into a career, into a thing that could be bought and sold. But the thing is that the very nature of being creative is something universal, and it's not something that can be owned. And if people can start to engage in that understanding that every day is an opportunity to be creative, however they want to define it, that's a way back to their original purpose and to their humanity, to their compassion, to their imagination, to a sense of wonder, which, you know, according to Brian Swim, who's a cosmologist, you know, that is what we need. These are the qualities we need in order to move through this next major kind of collective transition that we're going through. You know, it's like we're about to be majorly tested as a species, and we need certain qualities to be strong so that we can survive that test.
About to be. I don't know about you. I feel tested.
Yeah. Well, it's just going to
the test is on.
Yeah, it's on.
Let me ask you a question. That's, you talk about art being a commodity, and for both of us, our art is a commodity, right? That's like the way that you connect with people. Typically is by selling something, right? Or you create a commodity, something that can be taken, consumed, experienced, even if that's an experience.
Right.
Like that's a friction, and that's a dance to do. So like what comes up for you with the inherent irony of you're creating impermanent art that you then take a photograph of to make it permanent and sell it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a dance, man.
I mean, I'm sure you've thought about this, but I mean, how does it make you feel? Is it, you feel like sometimes it's a dance back and forth of feelings, or is it nothing?
I mean, it feels much older, in terms of, you know, I feel very much connected to the overall kind of the last maybe 1,000 years of life as an artist. Yeah. Which is, you know, I mean, this has been a struggle that's been going on in this craft forever.
Well, more recently when you could we couldn't capture things as much except for paintings until recently.
Sure. I mean, but the struggle of making a living as an artist, being able to do, to support yourself and to continue to create in the world. I mean, look, hundreds of years ago, artists had patrons.
Well, it's better than working for a king who could cut our heads off, you know?
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of my own art, you know, if you look back even to biblical times, you know, people were making shrines and altars for the collective nation, wherever you were, and the people or the community, it would be part of the obligation of the people to support your life. It wouldn't be through money. It would be through food and through housing and whatever. But
in some ways, that's still alive in Europe, where the state will sponsor art and basically give grants and so forth to essentially foster more of it. It's really a very, in our country at least, it's much more of this American ideal of, like, you know, pick yourself up by the bootstraps and figure it out if you want to make some art. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also think part of the challenge these days is because there's so much information online, like, things are expected to be for free, you know, and we've gotten into even, like, I mean, to the extent of, like, shipping. You know, like, because of Amazon, we expect to receive things for free, and we expect to go on Instagram and see as much art as we want for free, and on Spotify, we expect to hear music for free, and I think part of the challenge, the part of the beauty of that is a lot of information and beauty gets out into the world, but part of the problem is that it doesn't teach the people how to take care of their artists, and so people don't have this innate sense of obligation to take care of their people.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Just to play devil's advocate, I mean, we maybe could think that something that's happening is we're moving as a culture into a gift culture, or we're moving into a space where we don't want to be buying all these things. We want to be experiencing, enjoying, and giving. We just haven't quite – we're in the very, very, very – early baby steps of that, where right now it's just about expectation, but perhaps that's the seed of something quite beautiful.
Yeah. And I think, you know, learning what a gift is really important right now. There's an amazing book I just read called Lewis Hyde's The Gift. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's very academic, but it really goes into traditionally what a gift is in indigenous cultures, and how a gift traditionally moves in the world, and this innate sense of reciprocity with gifting, you know, that gifts, when you give a gift, traditionally it should always be moving. It should never be something that you receive and then it stays with you. And according to his scholarship, that's when a gift dies, is when you actually take a gift and it stays with you. You kill the gifting. Mm-hmm. But if you always kind of move it, like I give you a gift, you give someone a gift, and the gift is always in movement, then it teaches the people kind of the spiritual quality of what a gift really is, which is that it's something that can't be possessed.
Mm. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's gifting is also perhaps brought into practice by the practice of receiving gifts. You know, you ever notice how people, or ourselves even, someone give you a gift of a compliment and the initial response is, oh no, you know.
Yeah, right.
I grew up
like that.
You're such a wonderful, you know, person. Oh no, I'm not, you know.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's an interesting thought that we struggle with even what it means to receive the gift.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that, you know, part of the understanding of what art really is to inspire that kind of generosity.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it doesn't stay. And that's really the nature of my art, which is like, and the beauty that I've experienced over the years, which is like, I'll put out something on Instagram, I'll make an altar, and then some woman in Iran will tag me on an altar she made. You know, and it's just like, that's insanely incredible.
Yeah. You know? Does it feel weird, like, to be a child of Instagram?
Is that what I am?
you're one of its original children. I mean, that seems. I mean, is that where you've made the largest amount of your connection with your community?
I think so. Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of perfect for it. It's images based, and
it feels like a global gallery, art gallery. Sometimes, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, I love it. I mean, I don't get triggered in the same way that Facebook triggers me. Mm-hmm. You know, Instagram feels very, because it's image-based, it feels very accessible and creative and interesting. And I have a lot of engagement and I love it. I mean, I don't know. I don't have, because my art fits very well in that forum, I don't necessarily have like a hard time with it, but social media in general is a double-edged sword. Just
oh
because,
God. Yeah. It's, I could go on about that for a long time.
Yeah. But I mean, it's helped artists a lot and it's also hurt us.
Well, not just artists. Like I think it's interesting what social media is doing to the world. It's a double-edged sword like anything. It's a tool, but it's one that's such a slippery slope that we're using so unconsciously.
Yeah. Exactly.
We don't really fully let alone kids. We know for a fact by the people who designed that stuff about how it was designed to be addictive and work with our brain and dopamine. I mean, thousands of the most talented designers thought about things like how long is the delay to when the notification number appears on Twitter to when you open the page. And that's tied into like how much you're going to be satisfied and have to like click that. And I mean, it's all been thought through. It's all about fucking with your head.
And not only that, it's both fucked with and supported my career. I mean, when I first, we talked about this a while back, but like when I first was petitioning agents for my book, you know, I had an agent, this was years ago, I had an agent say to me like, well, what are your numbers? And at the time they were like 3, you know.
The quantification of people.
And she was jazzed about my art and wanted to sign me. And then when I told her my number, she's immediately shifted to tone and was like, yeah, why don't you call me back when they're actually something?
Same thing in the music industry. Same thing probably just about any industry now, because we all have sort of a quantified way of defining our worth. And that is one of the dangers of social media right now. How do we value people, especially now that, of course, it was only inevitable that things could be bought and shadows and mirrors so that you hardly know what the truth is anymore about these numbers.
Yeah. And then not only that, but like your own art too. Like, let's say you have a song and, you know, 500,000 people listen to that song and it's your like, you think, yeah, it's a pretty good song. And then you put out another song and you think it's your absolute best song and like maybe, you know, 10,000 people listen to it.
Yeah.
Does that shift your relationship with the music?
No. And that's a very slippery slope of pandering, right?
Sure.
You have to really think about the actual meaning of them too, because particularly a like, for instance, mm-hmm. I'm sure you've had the experience of liking something and moving on within before that second is even over.
Totally.
And it's almost a way of that person sort of checking in with that entity or person. Like it's about their own self-worth. Like I need to like these things to be connected to it in a certain way or my friend mm-hmm. or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But their actual engagement or value they're receiving from that thing is probably quite minuscule and obviously ephemeral.
Right. You know?
it's a strange thing. It's a strange thing. And as you know, because I know you've done some workshops where essentially you're turning these Instagrammers into real people right in front of you spending a day with you outdoors. And so the real, you know, that's got to be a much more real experience for you. It's just like playing a live show, I presume, or, you know, where it becomes real. You know, it's something in the flesh.
I don't, you know, I feel like part of my learnings these days is to be open to things that I don't know, especially around how my art impacts people.
Sort of letting it go, you mean?
Well, for instance, recently I got feedback from some lawyer in New York who contacted me that apparently like she doesn't have any time, she can't do workshops, she can't do this, she can't do that, but like having a moment in her day when she encounters my art like gives her a little bit of a breath in a very stressful environment. And like, I don't know what the hell that, how that impacts her, you know, like, I mean, she went out of her way to email me that it brings her a moment, you know, is that enough? You know, I have no idea. So I think part of the ephemerality of my work and also ephemerality of art in general is that, you know, you, once you let go of it, it takes on a life of its own. Yeah. And you never know how it's going to impact people and where it travels. And that's the beauty of art, is, and that's the beauty of the gift.
Yes.
Is that it's moving, it's traveling, and it moves through you, but it moves well beyond you.
Yes. Yeah, it's well put. And that's very, very true. I think it's a bit of a trap when you start to hold on to your creations too closely, because we are but conduits for something that's passing through us, right? The muse.
Amen.
The creativity of the universe. And it's something that we all are and all share. Yeah. So it's, I know for myself, when you get too attached to a creation, it can really stunt the growth of more.
Yeah.
And the point of making more is not to make more. It's going back to what you're saying, that every day there's this process. And for me, that process involves usually music. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like carpentry, you know, building. That's a creative process. But it's something where you're exercising that creative muscle. And so yeah. if you put things out and it becomes sort of a career and a business and you're connecting with people in the world, that's candy. That feels really good.
Mm-hmm.
But it can't. It is a little tricky, right? You know, not to be too attached to the, what's the saying? To be the labor, not the fruits,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. Your will and your choice of what you do with your time and how you use your gifts is what is beautiful about you as Day. You know, the gifts themselves, how you cultivate them, that I honor you for. The gifts themselves, I thank the universe for that you mm-hmm. have, you know, but, and, are they yours? I don't know where those come from. Where does talent come from, right?
Who the fuck knows?
Right, exactly.
I mean, it's such a bizarre thing. Look, I mean, it really, like, if I take enough steps back right now and just like look at my life, I mean, it's fucking bizarre. You know, there's no way that anyone would have predicted in my family that this would be my career. There's really no way I would have even predicted it. I'm not even sure like what it is right now, you know. I mean, it's so out of the normal or the ordinary. And for me, that in some way it has to start kind of speaking a little bit to a much bigger calling that is not self-directed. It's not self-chosen. I mean, yes, I choose this career, but in a way, I don't know how you feel about your music, but this has chosen me, and I don't know why. I don't know how. I don't think it matters. I think what matters is that I choose it back.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about what you choose and what chooses you. It's sort of that also is a dance of listening to what wants to happen and also cultivating it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I could have easily not, I could have said no to this. I still can.
Sure. And maybe let that be a great lesson to remind us that who knows where your life will take you next.
Yeah. And I'd like to speak a little bit in that same breath around fear, because, you know, being an artist is so much a not guaranteed thing, you know, like especially success and a capacity to support yourself and all of these things. And it feels like I'm sometimes walking on an invisible bridge. And there's a lot of faith that needs to be cultivated. And there's a lot of persistence and commitment that has to be cultivated. And a willingness to really walk with the unknown a lot in this career. And I have not mastered shit in this regard. But it's just, I guess I've more or less like permitted it to be a companion along the way. And so now I'm like, you know, it sits beside me every day. Like every day I'm just like, holy shit, you know?
Well, like, what do you mean? What are the things you do to when that, it's obviously a thought. So when a thought comes up, how do you confront it? How do you deal with it? What are the practices that work? I mean, is it simple as having tea, getting into your work, not attaching to it, smoking a joint?
You know, I would say for me, for instance, I'll give you an example. Like, rather than talking about the business aspect, I'll talk more about like writing this book recently. And, you know, I was actually near you. For whoever's listening, I just spent about 4 months in Southern Utah. And there was a lot of uncertainty throughout that process. Like, could I do it? You know, like some days, like I would wake up at dawn every day and, you know, sit at my seat every day ready to write. And some days there would be nothing that came through. And I had a deadline. So, you know, there was a practice that I needed to cultivate that was a little bit more like persistence. So it had me,
yes,
like no matter what, I was like, I told that muse, like, all right, if you don't want to come right now, that's fine. I'm going to sit here until you do. And then if it still didn't come, I would go out for a walk or I would take a break. But the returning was kind of the crucial aspect of it.
This is important. This is like small bricks. And, you know, obviously, sometimes like you have good days, bad days, right? And it's really important to see it as like each day is a brick in this process.
Yeah, it's a long game.
And not attaching to when you have those difficult moments or days, because like that's the creative process.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah.
And for me, it's like, I think that's a really important skill that we have to cultivate as people. And I think, you know, the tides of modern living is working against us in that regard, because we're so used to instant satisfaction and yes, instant gratification. And I think if things don't show up immediately, people get very unheartened and like they kind of tend to give up on things. But like, writing a fucking book takes time, and it's not about a sense of like daily reward. It's like, it's just like showing up every day, whether or not it comes, and like letting yourself know, letting the spirit know that this is happening. And you're, as you said, you're taking one brick and you're putting it in at a time, and like eventually something happens. But it's cultivating a willingness to stay in the game long enough to see it through.
Yes. And I think it's great to think, like, let's say you're not writing a book and you're just free writing. For what purpose each morning? Simply to express yourself and throw the pages out. Even better. It's just like, who cares? You're creating nothing but the cultivation of who you are. You're just sort of, it's like doing push-ups.
Yeah. Right.
And it is a struggle to sit down and do anything creative. For me, for you, for everybody. That's normal. You know, people don't realize that. Like it's normal to every day you have to climb that little mountain again.
Yeah.
That's exactly how it goes.
Yeah, and it's just what it means. I think it's part of the maturation of being an artist and being human. It's just like, you know, it's the long game. And I think that's the beauty of art and of, you know, kind of art and everything in general, is that can you think beyond your own personal life? Like, obviously this is all a practice for something bigger. So to me, it's like, you know, when like there's a, I can't attribute this to any tribe or particular culture, but I know in kind of a Native American indigenous expression of, you know, keeping in mind seven generations, and right, you know, it's like, with whatever you're doing, can you think beyond your own generation? Can you think beyond your own life? And I, you know, I think that that's true with anything. It's like, can you think the long game? Can you, when you sit down, can you think of a bigger vision than just your immediate gratification? And can you see if your art can impact something beyond you or beyond your lifetime even? And that to me is really exciting, because, you know, it's like, if you're only playing for your own needs and your own life, that's awesome. But that's not what we need more of in the world.
When it comes to art, like, I find that idea really intoxicating too, the idea of legacy. But I also wonder sometimes if that's just my ego wanting to be remembered.
Yeah, but like consider it if your name was forgotten.
It will be forgotten.
Yeah, so but your work is remembered or
it will be forgotten too eventually.
But what about but your work is making ripples. You're making ripples in the world, and fine, your name's forgotten and maybe even your music is forgotten, but in some capacity it's rippling out in ways, as we said, that you can never know where it gets to.
Well, I'm with you. I'm just pulling it's a part of my own fear of the motivation. And beyond anything, I think maybe what you're getting at is that when you're keyed in to a sense of something more than yourself, it's sort of like saying it's an act of service, meaning mm-hmm. that the work that you're doing, one would hope, is in some way just that, an act of service. It is serving something larger than just your immediate needs mm-hmm. and who you are as a person. And mm-hmm. I think not only is that beautiful, it tends to help the work really flourish and blossom.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think unfortunately we have a situation right now where most people put themselves in the center of their life.
Social media is a great example of that. You literally are your own PR agent.
Totally. But I think, if you look at it like a map or like a spider web or something like that, and like you're in the center of your life, which is actually a very adolescent mentality, because children always put themselves in the center. But I think the true nature of being an adult is that you kind of puncture the center and allow something greater and more mysterious to live there. And the service that you're talking about is in some way serving that mystery, serving that unknown, and serving that spirit. And I think, that to me is like what good art does, is it takes you out of the center of your life, and it puts something a lot more mysterious there. And you get to feel a part of something bigger than you.
I mean, all art, we hope, speaks to the mystery, right? It's like that's what it's all dancing around.
Hopefully, yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Like when you're doing your art and you're doing that process, particularly like in the artistic process, in your alters in particular, how do you deal with the struggles and blocks that come up in the actual process?
When I'm dealing with my art, when I'm making
The altars, yeah. Uh-huh. So it's just a solitary process, and I'm sure that process involves struggle and some failures and mm-hmm. obviously the elements, but when you're not feeling inspired or that judgment comes up, like what do you do?
I have different techniques that I use. I would say like one of them is actually built into the ritual of making the altars, which is a sweeping ritual. In order to clear space on the actual earth, I have
like
a small hand.
Literally clearing the space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's symbolic. So I not only sweep away the leaves and the bark and the berries from whatever's fallen from the trees, but I'm also ritualizing it into sweeping away, or it's not even sweeping it away. It's sweeping it more accurately out of the center. So I'm making, it's not like it's gone. I mean, doubt is, I think in some ways it's a very helpful companion, because without it, you don't actually get stronger or grow or try new things. I mean, doubt to me, like when it's there, it really forces me to try and, kind of like create something in its midst. But anyway, I don't sweep it away. I sweep it out of the center. And to me, that's like part of the ritual. It's one example of the ritual of my art. And for another example is like, I try new things. So the great part of my art is that I can keep on arranging. So if I try something out and I'm hating where it's going, I can just remove it and try something else. And I think there's that repetitive, kind of stop and go and try things out, and that it doesn't, maybe I get frustrated if I'm continuously not going in quote unquote the right direction of where I think I want to go.
How long does it take usually to make your normal, size?
A 3 foot by 3 foot could take me sometimes 6 to 8 hours.
That includes the gathering?
That can include the gathering, yeah. I mean, I'm going to be making one tomorrow. And I basically have cleared my, you know, all daylight.
Do you listen to music, or you just not vibe really out to the nature sound?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'll put on something that has a little bit of like a, like, do you know Dacha Bracha?
Not sure. Maybe that you played that for me, man, I think.
They're so fucking good. I think they're Eastern European. They have this like trancey vibe to them. If I'm feeling kind of like, you know, in kind of in a passionate or fiery mood, I'll put something like that on. But for the most part, I like spaciousness and the sound of the squirrels running up the redwoods, or
the sound of the absence hawk of noise, right?
Well, it's like not so much the absence of it as more so like just life around me.
But that's what I mean when I say the absence of noise, like trucks or you're hearing sound. It's just natural sounds
exactly
around you. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an important thing. Gordon Hempton had that quote, silence is not the absence of sound, but the absence of noise.
And right.
Totally. So, it's wonderful to find silence, which to me is easy as just going to nature.
Yeah. And I also I don't know how you are, but I tend to talk to myself while I'm making art.
Out loud or in your head?
Yeah, out loud. Well, I won't talk necessarily to myself. I'll talk to the pieces.
What do you say? Like, you're an awesome leaf, or?
More so like trying to get them to talk to each other.
Uh-huh.
So
where do you want to go?
Yeah, something like that. Like, like, oh, you guys, like, what if I put you over here? Like, do you want to play with the pine cone? You know,
and everyone wants to play with the pine cones. That's the problem.
It's true. You know, when I was living at the cabin recently writing the book, there was a bunch of guys working on a brick wall behind, not brick, stone wall behind the cabin. And I actually wrote about this in the book. I got to talking to them just about kind of what they call the Zen of stone. And because it's a very similar process from what they've told me to what I do, which is all about helping material be in relationship to itself. And so they're kind of chiseling the stone so that it fits in a certain way and it wants to cooperate with the other stones that it's laying on or laying next to. And it's very relational. And I wrote about this in the book because I think that that's part of the magic of art and the magic of being human, is that, you know, it's really about negotiation and learning how to be in relation, how to encourage relationships with, you know, friends or family or pine cones and berries. And so, you know, I'll talk to them. I'll like, you know, plead with them. I'll even talk to the wind. You know, I've had so many experiences where like the wind comes and fucking blows everything away after like 8 hours of working. And if I feel the wind coming, you know, I'll talk to the wind. And part of it is actually like being in an animate relationship with the earth, where it's not just something, you're not a victim of it, you're not separate from it, but like you can be in dialogue with it and in that way feel more connected.
Hey man, just today, I was near where you made an altar quite a while ago.
Uh-huh.
I took a picture of it because it's sort of still there. And I think it's holding
you
up.
Did?
Yeah. Do you remember the one you made like on the...
Oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if this is even possible, but if you had a whole series of photographs of old altars, like a year later, that are still there, super decayed, and
I take photographs of every altar decaying.
I just think it's so interesting, that process of the interaction of wind and animals and people, and how it just starts to change over time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that to me is more interesting when you talk about impermanent art, is like watching it go away.
Yeah.
I mean, how often do you get to see that in art? It's almost always something that's memorialized.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's heartbreaking, you know, because
it is heartbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's heartbreaking because it's like, I love the piece and I want to show it to all my friends and,
yeah,
you know, and I want it to last and the piece doesn't. And all I have is kind of like a photograph of what it was. And, you know, in some way that is good. I mean, it gets around it and it moves people, but there's something different than just like showing up on a path in a forest and you come across something that is just, it's not a photograph where you're sitting in your office and you're listening to, you know, you're like doing your own thing and you're seeing something on a computer screen or on your phone. There's something about like coming to a path on a hike and suddenly like amidst the trees and whatever, you get a glimpse of color and you look down and you see this geometric pattern, and it's, you know, it's much more inclusive and experiential and alive. And so I love that. And it's very unique when people get to see my pieces in person versus on the screen. And
yeah.
And so, yeah, but the ephemerality of it all is, you know, it's part of the kind of the wisdom and spiritual teaching of my work, which is about letting go.
About death, right?
About, I mean, death.
To me, that's what comes up, is it shoves it right in my face. And it's something that,
yeah,
I've been thinking about a lot for a few years, and it seems to be something in my consciousness quite often. Something about coming closer to death, what death is, the idea of death, the feeling of death. It's obviously intimately connected to what it means to be alive.
Yeah.
And how, I mean, we live our life.
Exactly.
I don't have an answer, but I'm just saying it's the talk about the ultimate. It's the ultimate dance that we did. Yeah. We all are doing it. Even though, like, I could argue that every single thing we do in our life is in reaction to the notion that we know we're going to die.
Well, I disagree. I actually think most people operate as if they don't know that.
It's unconscious, is my point.
Well, listen, you know, I've studied quite a bit with Stephen Jenkinson and the Orphan Wisdom School, and we're processing this all the time. And one of the things that we talk about a lot is how most people don't operate as if they know they're going to die.
Correct.
And so that muscle that you were talking about earlier today, that muscle of relating to life as if it's impermanent, is atrophied. Mm-hmm. And we get kind of like caught up in this, like, you know, that we're trying to make things last, or we're only relating to life as if it's going to happen forever and indefinitely.
Wouldn't you say that that's more of a, definitely an affliction of what our lives in the Western world, because like I would say a lot of Eastern cultures, even to this day, see themselves more of as a cog and a greater wheel versus us. We see ourselves each as the wheel.
I had a friend 2 years ago who died. He was a Sufi teacher. He was incredible human being and very, very interesting character. But you know, he was like connected to Judaism, Christianity, and he was Sufi. And his culture gave him at the time, when he was 13, they give you, I don't remember the Sufi name for it, but essentially they give you the cloth that your corpse will be wrapped in.
Oh, right, right. I heard about that.
And your job is to keep it around you every day. Hmm. And to be in relationship with that cloth every day.
Right.
As a reminder that you're going to be in this one day, and that is part of your everyday living. And I think that is so powerful because, you know, if we can really live by seeing everything that has come before us, that's feeding our life, that is dead, and that one day our dead lives will feed lives in the future, to me, that is a game changer when it comes to how to live your life, which is both to be in relationship, to exercise that muscle with death, every day, or impermanence, same thing.
How do you do that?
I do it through my art, number one. Number two, I mean, you know, you can see it, but I can name a few different ways. My art, number one. The thing that you can see because we're zooming, you can see behind me, but most...
You mean we're on video right now so I can see you.
Yeah, and the wall behind me is about 75 photographs of my recent ancestors. And this is it's a monumental wall in my house because every day I encounter all those that have come before me. And basically without any one of them on this wall, my life would not be here. So I encounter my ancestry every day, you know, just in terms of like visualization, seeing them.
Right. We often forget that people come out of people, like circles within circles within circles within circles.
Yeah, indefinitely.
Yeah.
And not just people, animals and plants, you know, they had to eat those too. And then also my food is a major way that I relate to death every day.
You're not a vegetarian anymore.
Not anymore.
Right. No.
Had really good sausage this morning.
You've made sausage, right? You did that once.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you still sausage. Eat it.
I do. Not the ones that I made, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's another way that I relate to life. And it's, you know, it's like not black or white. You know, when I was a vegetarian, I think I saw things a little bit more black and white. But as a meat eater right now, you know, I'm seeing kind of the beautiful heartbreak of what it takes to be alive, which is you have to actually kill things to survive. That's just part of the architecture of life on this planet.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, I eat meat as well. And yesterday I was coming home from the studio, which is about 10 miles from here. It's about a 15-minute drive. And there's been this flock of turkeys that I've been seeing. And I have my bow in my car because, you know, it's been a bit of a goal of mine to bow hunt and get a turkey and make my own turkey stews and stuff from an actual turkey that I was able to kill myself. And so this is the second time now that I've seen them, and I've fired off a total of 3 arrows at them. I've obviously missed. Lo and behold, it's harder to hit a moving target than one that is stationary, such as a hay bale that I practice on. But I'll tell you why I missed, because you know you sneak up on them from the other side, and they're quite crafty, even though they're small and stuff, but I had to fire that arrow probably with the moment I was ready, and I waited about 2 or 3 seconds because I was thinking about how I actually didn't want to kill them.
Mm.
I didn't. But the part of me that's saying you should do this, Trevor, is not because I want to kill anything. I really don't. But it's like you do this all the time from 1 degree away by eating this stuff all the time, right?
Do you think that if you had to kill it, that 2 seconds wouldn't be there? Like if you were hungry.
Yeah, I think that would go away. I think this whole, I mean, it's a process in my mind of privilege, obviously, of abundance.
Yeah.
But I noticed that. I just noticed that like I didn't really want, because I see the same pod of turkeys. It's like 12 turkeys. They're like a group. It's the same one that I'm seeing each day. They're just moving around a different area. And I know this is like anthropomorphizing like the turkeys themselves. But I'm like, well, if I kill one of them, they're going to miss that one. Or who's going to mourn that? And I know that's true. And I don't like that, but I also don't want to be a vegetarian, mostly because I know that my body needs meat. I know that those amino acids and stuff, I just do better with my mental health and my well-being when I can eat those things. And I know people might argue I can get it in different ways, and that this hasn't been my experience. My point is that it really brings right to the forefront this issue that you talk about the tragedy and the horror and beauty, the sacred and the profane of being human, of being alive. And in some ways, you know, death is the same, is the other, the polarity of birth. And it's again showing us, it all comes back to these polarities that we live with and what it means to be in this dimensional reality of human, right? Of sleep, of wake, of birth, of death, of eating, you know, and killing and so forth. And
can I give you like a small example recently? I had, I just sent in my manuscript a few days ago again to my publisher. And one of the things that she wrote back was, a lot of people are asking her, she's asking me for clarity on this. A lot of people are asking her, like, if I have any ethical problems with cutting and removing plants.
You've said people have given you shit about that. Like, hardcore. Yeah. Like, there's always going to be the hardcore.
Yeah.
Like, how dare you? I got shit for making Karens and taking pictures from someone.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, like that I was destroying nature and that Karens are destructive and ugly. I was like, thanks for your input. You know what I mean? I know there's a button, but there's no fuck off button, you know?
Well, I think it's evidence that there's like, you know, like the feedback, I'm not going to put it into one category. I think on some level, there's a major disconnection from the earth. People that like are viewing their human relationship with the earth as if it should be like see but don't touch kind of thing. But I often have gotten shit from like park rangers, you know, like who are trying to ask me to obey a certain law. And I think, you know, when it comes down to it, it's really about intention and behavior. And like, how are you, like, what is your intention with the plant? Like, you know, what is your intention with the animal? What's your behavior around it? Like, how are you approaching taking, you know, even if you're going to kill an animal, or if you're going to take a plant or cut a plant, to me, it's all about approach. It's all about intention. And I think that, you know, there's a way, like I'm thinking about that scene. I know this is kind of lame in terms of like a cultural reference, but I'm thinking about that scene in Avatar where she like, they kill a certain animal that's chasing when they first meet, and she slits its throat and then like offers a prayer for it, that it finds its way back to its pack. And then he's kind of I forgot his name, but he's pretty ignorant. And he goes like, thanks for killing that, you know, animal. I'm so glad. And she's like, there's no thank you here. Like this is not good. Like I had to do it, you know? And I think that is, you know, it's really about approach and intention. And I think part of the way that we can reclaim our relationship with anything is to ask yourself, like, what's in your approach?
Yeah. And also not to make it so black and white, right? Like with meat, for instance, you can choose the kind of meat you eat and spend more money if you have it to get stuff that's as local or seem like
ethical.
There's a cow that a lot of us eat in town, and it's literally one cow that is raised here. It's slaughtered here, and then we all help pay for the meat. But that to me doesn't take away the tragedy of killing that animal. But
no, but it brings you into relationship with it.
The intention you were talking about, I think, it helps me be more intentional. And there's a lot of vestiges of this stuff in religion, like saying grace before we eat. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of empty now, but you know, it's just speaking that gratitude just to yourself of like, man, like a lot happened for this, for me to have this, and just taking a few seconds to honor that. I think it can really help your own internal process of, you know, what it means for you.
But I want to just go back for a second in terms of when I said the word relationship, because I really think it comes down to, because for instance, like, you know, it's not a big deal if you eat a piece of meat from an animal that you've never met, that maybe came from a factory wrapped in plastic that you bought at Safeway, you know. But there's something about, I don't know if you've had this privilege, but there's something about like, let's just say you were there for the birth of a pig. And let's just say you spent, you know, 10 years raising it, feeding it, and taking care of it every day and getting to know it. And let's just say you were a part of the slaughter of that pig. And let's just say that like the following weeks, you ate of the animal that you helped bring into the world, that you raised, that you slaughtered. It's a completely different way of eating.
Yeah. And I agree with you. And I just don't expect, most people are like, that's impossible for the reality. And I get that. I'm not here to give anyone a prescription about food. I mean, talk about the ultimate religion is what we all eat and how we eat. And it's But it's hard, though. It's hard for people to get that close to their food today. It really is.
But forget the food. I'm just talking about relationships. So, like, for instance, with my art, you know, it's not necessarily about, like, can I take a leaf from a tree? The question is, what's my relationship to the tree?
And that comes up to your own internal process, right?
No, partially, but it also comes down to, like, am I willing to, like, do I pass a tree every day? Am I willing to sit with it? Can I give it an offering? It's about different ways of being in relationship with the earth and with the plant. And I don't know what that is to people. Being in relationships is a very nuanced thing. You know, sometimes it involves gifts, sometimes it involves communication, and sometimes it involves just being there and showing up. But to me, the thing that we're missing these days is how to tend to a relationship, how to be in relationship. And I think that's in regard to food, that's in regard to art, that's in regard to romantic relationships. But to me, it's about, like, what is your way of giving in relationships? And that can change your life, you know? And so, to me, that's the real essence of the food that we're talking about, is, like, it's relational. And I think part of the industrialization of everything, whether it's art or food, is that it's cut us off from being in relationship with things.
Well, it seems to be like something you're talking about there. It goes back to the beginning of this conversation, and that relationship is about giving and the gift. And I know that's with people and relationships in our lives. It's giving feels good, man. It's the golden rule. There's a lot of truth in that.
It's true. And to realize how much you're being given.
Yeah. And I don't want people to have to self-flagellate, but I think that's a nice way.
I do.
Maybe you want to watch that. Well, that's a good way to maybe wrap this up. I like leaving it with the gift. Thanks for your gift of your time.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me, like, when this book is coming out, if you know what it's called, how people can find you?
Sure. The book is called Morning Altars. As of right now, the working subtitle is The Wonder and Ritual of Earth Art.
Mm-hmm.
It is being published October 2018 of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find out more information about the book, about my art, about my travels on morningaltars.com. And that's morning altars, altars.
So you're not mourning like sad. That'd be like some crazy hipster
name. And it's
not
altar like alters, even though I fucking own that website too.
You should. Good for you. You're playing the game right. Well, thanks, buddy.
And you and I are going to be at Tree Fort next week.
This probably won't be out by then, but yes, I hope we've done some collaborating in the past of music and art, and I hope to do more.
Amen.
Yeah, and we could do this again and maybe talk about whatever, you know, other things. It doesn't have to just, I just wanted people to get introduced to your work and what the process is for your work.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, brother.
Too. Yep. Good to talk to you, man.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of 10 Laws with East Forest, a podcast coming to you, well, weekly for now. That's the plan. This track you're hearing in the background is called Love Bug, and it is a bonus track off the album Love Bomb. And the bonus tracks from that record are only available on the Bandcamp for East Forest. So if you go to eastforest.org and you head over to the music section, and it's an album-only bonus track. So if you purchase the album, there's three bonus tracks there, and Love Bug, this song, is one of them. One thing I like about this track is that it has live drums and live bass, and so it's just sort of a straight-up trio-type song. And it was Sean Fleming on the drums, and Nathaniel Daniel played the bass. It didn't fit in the album because a lot of the album had electronic drums, and for some reason this one just felt like it was in a little bit different world, but I always liked the vibe. I just really dug it, and I really enjoyed producing it and getting some of that live drum sound in there. If you do enjoy this, please give us a review on iTunes. Only the good ones, folks. Only the good ones. You can send us your support financially right now with PayPal at info@eastforest.org. And please spread the word.
Send us your love, send us your questions, send us your comments. Let us know that this is getting out to the void. We'll see you next time. Keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. And if you do, do it with grace.